Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. As usual, we have our phone lines open today. We are live for an hour. This is our normal format, Monday through Friday at this same time. 5 days a week we do this. Open up for an hour, a phone line for you to call on the air and ask if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith that you would like to deal with, discuss, have conversation about. And if you see things differently than the host does, that is, you have a different viewpoint, you'd like to balance comment, you can call about that as well. We can discuss that very readily. We have 1 hour to do that kind of thing, and the sooner you call, the earlier you get your foot in the door, and we can hope to get you on the air. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Michael calling from Live Oak, California. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you as always.
Yeah, so, welcome.
Last week we were talking about, I was saying that the conditions of different people, their abilities, their circumstances, to see it as just God's will would seem a bit random and capricious. And I was going to add another point or bring up another point, but I actually maybe put that on back burner. I think there's a more pressing issue that I wanted to bring up. In that discussion that we had last week, you said everybody is a responsible agent or something like that. Everybody can choose God or not choose God. But I wanted to question that because just looking at my own life and my own what I would call negative karmic baggage or sin, it's very, very heavy, very thick. And it seems when somebody is so enmeshed in that, they don't know anything else. Like a fish in water doesn't know that it's wet. It only knows the water, wetness. But it seems it takes a certain clarity to even recognize that one is being driven by that. So it seems very opaque at times, and that person would really have no choice but to follow their instincts.
Well, that's not exactly true. I understand what you're saying, and when we discussed this previously, I actually made allowance for the fact that not everybody has an equally clear path laid out for them to God. I mean, some people have access to accurate knowledge about God and have an upbringing that maybe makes them open and welcoming of the ideas of God. Other people have been born in situations where access to that information is very difficult or maybe not even available, and their upbringing may actually be a great detriment to them. The environment they've been in might make it very hard for them to give God serious consideration or believe that he exists. Now, I recognize that, and that's what you're saying. The difference is, I would say that the level of responsibility is mitigated, perhaps, in some degree, by factors like that. But I believe that even unless somebody is born extremely, mentally disabled and not able to think clearly about anything, well, then everybody has some ability. Even a child has a developing ability to recognize that some things are right and some things are wrong. Maybe a child doesn't intuitively know there's a God, though I think I've read some statistics, even from secular sources, that almost all children in elementary school, until they're taught otherwise, believe there's a creator. They believe that that's, you know, the way that their instincts lead them to believe, and educators are urged by Darwinists to get this out of the heads of children, because even children from atheist families, the study showed, tend to believe that there's a creator until their parents or educators get that out of their head. So it may be more instinctive than we realize. Now, of course, if a person's in an abusive background, or if all, let's say Christianity is true, as I believe it is, and a person is raised in a situation where they only have bad exposure to Christians, you know, that the so-called Christians they know are mostly hypocrites, they're abusers, they're haters, or whatever. Let's just say they've never seen a good example of a Christian in their life. Well, obviously, those people are going to be a little handicapped in that they may be considerably handicapped in that they're going to be less eager to learn about the faith system of those people that have been so unimpressive to them. But at the same time, God knows. God knows how many disadvantages a person has, and I believe he takes those into consideration. Jesus said that the servant who knew his master's will and did not obey it will be beaten with many stripes. The servant who didn't know his master's will but did things worthy of stripes will be beaten with fewer stripes. This is referring to the discipline of a disobedient servant. The one who knew better will deserve a severer punishment than one who didn't have quite the same grasp of knowledge of the master's will. It makes it very clear that God sees a difference in his judging of people who have not gone the right way. How little they knew and how much they knew will be taken into consideration. Now,
you're not saying that God is morally relativistic, though, right?
No, he's an absolute standard of right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, any just court will give a break to somebody who was speeding on a road where the speed that he was going seemed to be safe, but the speed limit sign had fallen down, and there was no way for him to know what the speed limit was. You know, so if somebody was going faster than the speed limit, but going a safe speed, and didn't know what the speed limit was, and had no way of knowing what the speed limit was, obviously the judge will have to either let him off, even though he has broken an absolute standard of speed limit. The standard is absolute, but the guilt is not. The culpability is not absolute. The standards are unbending, but the individual assessment of responsibility depends on, of course, how responsible the agent is. If a person does something very irresponsible and people die, and that person should have known better, well, then that person is guilty of, you know, negligent manslaughter. If the person who did the act was seriously brain damaged and was known to be incapacitated mentally, well, then, of course, a judge would assess the guilt level of that person differently. But the act is still wrong. Doing things that kill people wrongfully is wrong no matter who does it. It's just that the culpability is greater for those who should know better than for one who can't be expected to know better. The point here is that when we talk about differing degrees of knowledge, no one who discusses this subject is at one of the low levels of information. The people who are at low levels of information don't even know this is a question to discuss. The persons who always bring this up are people who have access to the information, and they say, wow, but what about people who don't? Well, that's a question that God certainly knows more about than we do. But let's take yourself, for example. You mentioned that your situation, which your karma has put you in or whatever, has made it more difficult for you. And I won't deny that. I think you probably have had a more difficult life than I have. I don't know, but just knowing you the little I do, I think you probably have had some difficulties that I have not had. But at the same time, you are making moral choices, responsible moral choices every day. That's why you can be a Buddhist and you can embrace what you consider to be Buddhist truths as opposed to rejecting them. You can embrace Buddhist disciplines instead of rejecting them. These are responsible choices. You could as easily embrace Christian truth and Christian disciplines if that was what you wished to do. If you wanted to know whether Christianity is true, you could, with as open mind as you can muster, you could look at the evidence for Christianity and say, well, okay, these evidence are good. They're compelling. I should be a Christian. And the failure to do so, especially in a case like yours, Michael, could not be said to be, well, I was born ignorant. Well, all people are born ignorant, but you're a young enough man and have been hearing Christian truths long enough that you certainly have had opportunities. Now, lots of people haven't had the opportunities you've had, and no doubt God will judge them by, you know, a different standard of culpability. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the people who ask that particular question are not the ones who are the low information people. They are the people who know, hey, this is something that God's requiring. What's he going to do about it for these people over here who don't know about it? Well, fortunately, God is smart enough to know what to do with them. But the question is, are we smart enough to know what to do with the information we have?
Well, actually, hanging out with Christians, going to the Bible study, which I do every week, it helps me to see my own weaknesses and my own blind spots that much more clearly, which is the aim of Buddhist practice, to just recognize.
Well, and I'm sure also, Michael, that when you've hung out with Christians, as you have done a lot, that not every Christian has been an exemplary example of Christianity. But you've also known some who are, you could certainly conclude that their walk with Jesus has made them very much better people than they might otherwise be. Of course, that's not the proof of Christianity, but it confirms it in measure. And obviously, even if you were one of those people who had only bad experiences with Christians in the past, you wouldn't be able to say that about the last few years.
Oh, no. I tell people I'm almost a Christian at this point.
Yeah,
it's just there's certain things like what I brought up about reincarnation that it still makes sense to me in terms of a worldview. But.
You know, I was thinking about you just the other day. Frankly, I was in the shower thinking about reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
I always think about things, no matter where I am, and I happen to be thinking about reincarnation and its ramifications. And I was thinking how strange it would be and how unjust it would be if you or I came into this life suffering for, wrongdoings that we had done in a previous life, which we don't even remember,
Right, and people bring that up quite a bit, yes.
Yeah, and that if we have no memory of those things, it can hardly serve as a punishment, a useful punishment for them. When a child does something wrong and receives punishment and can connect in his own mind, this punishment happened to me because I did this wrong thing, that allows the child to improve and say, well, I better not do that again. But if somebody is suffering punishment but has not the slightest memory of anything they did in a previous life to do it, there's hardly any, even if we would argue this is the same person back again in a new body, in what sense are they the same person?
No,
they have no mental connection.
You just actually hit on the core point, and no, I'm sure we would not have time to go into it, but let me just say this very quickly. So it's not really punishment. It's more if you plant what's some poison? I can't think of a poisonous plant, but some type of toxic plant or tree.
Okay.
You'll get that type of a you'll get the bitter fruit.
So it's the natural outcropping of it, right?
Yeah, it's like the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians. It's really the same idea. Certain things lead to certain qualities, characteristics.
What you sow, you'll reap, in other words.
And, exactly. On a grander scale than might be understood in the Bible.
I understand. But again, the question would be, of course, who is it that's exacting this result? Who is it that's giving this person another chance to go through life and get it better next time? The ultimate reality in your system is the Tao. Is that right?
The Dharma?
The Dharma, that's right.
Yep.
The Dharma. And the Dharma is not personal. So the Dharma doesn't have any particular feelings about things. Is that right?
The way that all of this plays out in the big scheme of things, it's actually said to be, it's like unknowable. Like, I think you would acknowledge that the mind of God is not something that human beings can fathom. So in a similar way, the functioning of the Dharma is beyond human conception. It's vast.
Okay, but if the Dharma actually did have personality, let's say feelings and a mind, mm-hmm. and things like that, then there'd be really no distinction between what you're calling the Dharma and what anyone else calls God. Is that right?
That's basically how I see it, Steve, really.
You see it as God. You see it as a conscious being.
You could, whatever it is that is the force or intelligence that is behind the way things manifest, yeah.
Okay, so if you're simply using the word Dharma for another word for what I might call God.
Yeah.
Okay. Then your biggest problem is that in Christianity, God is viewed as having a fatherly role toward us and toward Jesus. And that's something a personal God is something that you've argued with me about that in the past.
Yeah. that sense of being honored as a person rather than an impersonal presence, that's what actually draws me to Christianity. The agape quality.
But see, in some of our former conversations, that's been the thing that was actually stumbling you, as you couldn't picture God being personal.
Well, I say within the Dharma, there's room, there's a place for agape love. I don't necessarily see it as an old man with a beard sitting on a throne in heaven.
No, nor do very many Christians, as far as I know, unless they're very unschooled. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then you may be closer to a belief in theism than you used to be, I think, or than you used to talk about being.
And this Bible study group, I just can't say enough good things about it. I mean, it's wonderful. Every Tuesday at the Calvary Chapel in Aptos, and it's very similar to your meetings. There's just a sublime, sacred presence.
As I would hope there would be, and I'm glad to hear it. I'm sure those are wonderful people.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Michael, I need to take another call. I need to take another call. Did you get a chance to say what you called about?
Yeah, Steve. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, we'll talk again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling today. All right. We're going to talk now to Christopher from Miami, Florida. Christopher, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, Mr. Greg. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to hear from you.
I have a real question, but I decided to put it aside because yesterday I was listening to your show, and you said something about living in a house that had a former sickness.
I mentioned that I'd lived in a house. Can you hear? Can you hear me? I need to correct you. I didn't live in a house that had a former sickness. I had a house that had been inhabited by occult practitioners and appeared to have demons associated with it. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. That must have been a phone miscommunication. Yeah, I said Satanist.
Oh, you said a Satanist. Oh, okay, I thought you said sickness. Okay, I guess I'm not hearing you very well. Okay.
Yeah,
my
I'm
mistake.
Sorry. I was just wondering if you would be open to elaborating on what the experiences were.
Well, in the first instance, it was simply noises that were there from the first night I moved in. And it was a small apartment. I've always lived, especially in my younger adult life, very modestly. I lived in really cheap places. And it was a one-bedroom place where the bedroom door opened onto the living room, and that was all there was. There was a kitchen and a bathroom, too. But that was the whole place. And my bed was right next to the door of the bedroom, so that the living room was just, 2-3 feet from where I was lying. And each night as I went to bed, there was the sound of someone walking in the apartment. Now, a one story building. There was no one upstairs or downstairs. This is just a one story building. And the floor, which was old and wooden, was creaking to the rhythm of a person walking, and there'd be a thud of a footfall, and you'd hear the boards creak under it just as you would when someone's walking. There was no mistaking it. And it didn't happen any other time. If you sat there in the daytime, you wouldn't hear it. And it was not the kind of noises that, the house makes as the temperature changes and the boards creak. It was rhythmic. It was like somebody walking around for some period of time. And I would get up and look to see and make sure there was no one there, and there certainly was no one there. And this happened for several nights in a row until I finally just concluded. I'd heard enough about poltergeist. I'd heard the word poltergeist, by the way, in German means a noisy ghost. I'd heard about poltergeists, and I'd heard about such things before. And so I just addressed it, and I commanded in the name of Jesus that it go away. It stopped immediately and never came back. A person could interpret that differently if they want to, but I would have no reason I'd have no motivation to interpret it differently. It fits very well into the paradigm of a biblical worldview, and it certainly fits the facts. The other instance was a case where I was actually heading up a Christian outreach house in Oregon, Albany, Oregon, actually. And we rented a big old house for about a dozen of us to live in. And we were doing local outreach. This was back in 1978. And we didn't hear noises or things like that. But what happened was there was a very bizarre set of, what shall I say, hostilities that arose among fast friends, people who were very good and long-standing friends, and there was nothing happening to cause the hostilities. It was just like an inexplicable hostilities would arise, and people would become offended by really nothing. And I actually called the house together two different times to try to address it and see what the problem was, and no one was able to identify any real offense. But even as we met and talked about it, one person would say something quite innocuous, and another person across the room would hear it as a most scandalous and insulting statement that had nothing about it that was even provocative. And I would point that out, and it would keep happening. And one of the girls there says, you know, do you suppose maybe there's something, you know, satanic or demonic going on here? Maybe someone's, you know, once we say something, before it's, you know, reaches the ears of the hearer, it's getting twisted around and sounds different to them. And I didn't accept that. I just thought, oh, nonsense. We're just being immature here. You know, I mean, I came from Calvary Chapel, where the tendency, although they do believe in demons, tendency in Calvary Chapel is to downplay the likelihood of demons involved in anything, because they want to say pretty much it's all the flesh. And I was a product of that. And so I'd say, no, it's not demonic. That's ridiculous. That's we're just being immature, and people aren't listening carefully, and so forth. But this kept happening. It became so pronounced within just a few days, no one could get along anymore, and there was no reason. And so I actually disbanded the whole house and gave it up. I disbanded the ministry, and everyone went out and found other places to live. And the night before we gave the house up, I spent the night alone in the house. And as I lay in the house on a couch, one of the few pieces of furniture left, there was nothing that I could sense with my actual senses. But I had, and anyone who's not a Christian or who has never had any spiritual discernment of any kind would probably just think this is entirely, you know, psychological. And I'll let them think that, because I'm not interested in convincing anyone of anything. I'm just telling you what happened. I became aware in my spirit of hordes of demons in the place, and there was no one there, but it was almost like they were having a party, and they were laughing, and they were chattering, and so forth, and there was really nothing there. And I just got up and left the house, and left it to itself, and never went back. But I my conclusion is that was demonic, even though I doubted it, even though I was doubting it when people suggested it, I just wasn't buying it. But the experience I had that night persuaded me. And the next day, we found a notebook, not in the house, but in another house where we'd been having some fellowship. And one of the women in town who had been coming regularly to our Bible studies there had accidentally left it. And the owner of the home found it and started reading it, and kind of her blood went cold when she was reading it. She showed it to me. And lo and behold, this woman was deeply involved in the occult somehow, and was communicating with a demon, was communicating with a spirit, and it was talking back to her, and there was like dialogue. She was like automatic writing what the demon was saying to her, and then she'd be saying things to it. And this notebook had this dialogue between her and an evil spirit, and it was specifically counseling her what to do to undermine and destroy this house, this ministry house that we had. These are simply, I'm just reporting the facts. If somebody wants to put the facts together and reach different conclusions than I have, anyone is certainly welcome to do so. Like I said, I don't have anything I care to prove to anybody, but certainly nobody can prevent me from putting my own interpretation on it based on my own understanding and worldview. And so those were two cases where I actually had, and I've lived in 20 or 30 houses in my lifetime, but only those two times had I moved into houses where I didn't know anything about the history of them. You know, the first one I mentioned, there had been a witch there before, but I didn't know it. A friend of mine, after I no longer lived there, he told me that he knew the woman who was there, and he said, you should have seen it before you were there. Don't, walls are all painted black, and all these, you know, hexagrams and all these, you know, occult symbols were on the walls, and that was the inhabitant before I moved in. But anyway, these are things that I have no problem taking at face value in my worldview. Some people do. Some Christians even do. And so I just give you the information, and you can reach your own conclusions.
Yeah, I believe you. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, the Bible says. So, anyway, thank you, Mr. Greg.
All right. I appreciate your call, Christopher. God bless. Okay, another Chris is calling, and this is Chris from Carmichael, Washington. I mean, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Yeah, hi, Steve. I called you the other day, and I asked you about prophecies in the Old Testament regarding Jesus' second coming.
Yeah.
And we tended to agree with one another that the Old Testament prophecies were about his first coming and that they were fulfilled. A friend of mine pointed out Acts chapter 3, verses 18 through 21.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me your understanding of those, along, you know, coupled with your understanding from the answer the other day? And
yes.
I'll take my answer off the air if I can.
Sure, gladly. I appreciate your call. Yeah, Peter here makes reference to something that all the prophets spoke about, which he calls the restoration of all things. He says in, we could start in verse 21, like you said, Acts 3:21. Peter is preaching, he says, about Jesus, that the heavens must receive him until the times of the restoration of all things, which God has spoken of by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began. And then he quotes Moses about the prophet that will arise. And then he says in verse 24, yes, and all the prophets from Samuel and those who follow, as many as have spoken, have also foretold these days. Now, I might also point out that a couple of verses before the section in verse 18 says, but those things which God foretold by the mouth of all his prophets that Christ must suffer, he has thus fulfilled. Okay, so Peter three times in this section talks about what God has prophesied by the mouth of all his prophets. One of them is about that Christ must suffer. Another is that the prophets spoke, as Peter said, of these days, apparently the days in which they were living. But this other one, where that he spoke of times of restoration from the presence of the Lord will come, as was spoken, or the time of restoration of all things, I should say, which all the prophets have spoken of. Now, we'd have to ask, first of all, which prophets spoke about the time of the restoration of all things, and exactly what is the time of the restoration of all things that all the prophets spoke about? I've heard a lot of theories about what the restoration of all things refers to, but it's not always easy to find a reference to those particular ideas in the Old Testament. What I do see in the Old Testament is many references to God restoring the world, that is, restoring the world to himself, including the Gentiles. There's quite a few prophecies in the Old Testament. Lots of prophets spoke about the, you know, God, you know, reaching the nations, the Messiah establishing his kingdom in the isles of the sea and in the far reaches, and him reigning from sea to sea and so forth. All these things are, I believe, inaugurated at Pentecost. And the process has been going on ever since Pentecost. Now, in that respect, there are things going on today and throughout the whole church age, the evangelization of the world, that were predicted in the Old Testament prophets. You asked me originally, do I believe there's anything predicted in the Old Testament prophets that, you know, is fulfilled after 70 AD? I usually say to that question, I don't know if I said it quite so precisely when we talked about it, but my usual answer to that is, I don't know of any specific events that are prophesied in the Old Testament that have a fulfillment after 70 AD. Now, I don't consider the process of evangelizing the world as a specific event. Certainly the restoration of mankind to God through the preaching of the gospel is not an event so much as a process that's been going on for 2,000 years. The event that began it was Pentecost, and it certainly began then. It extended, of course, long beyond 70 AD, but not as if anything new or new events occurred after that. It's more like the same process that was inaugurated before 70 AD continues until it's all done. So if I need to put a finer point on my statement, when Peter said the time of the restoration of all things, which was spoken of by all the prophets, I believe he's referring to the restoration of the world through the preaching of the gospel, the restoration of mankind to God, and especially referring to what the prophets said about the Gentiles and about, you know, God giving Jesus the ends of the earth for his possession and so forth. This process did begin long before 70 AD. Well, I say long, several decades before 70 AD. And, you know, 70 AD didn't stop it. The process is an ongoing process. So there are things going on now which are the fulfillment of this prophecy, but they're not specific events that are predicted. It's more like the continuation of a process that was predicted and began to be fulfilled before 70 AD. So if I need to be a little clearer about what I mean when I say there are no specific events prophesied in the Old Testament that are to occur after AD 70, or that I don't know of any, let's put it that way, then maybe that'll clarify it. Now, I think I did mention an exception, though, because there's not, I can't say there's none, because the little horn of Daniel chapter 8, or excuse me, of Daniel chapter 7, rises out of the Roman Empire. And there's actually a reference to the fourth beast, which is the Roman Empire, being destroyed and burned in Daniel 7. And obviously the fall of Rome did not occur before 70 AD. And so the prophecies of Daniel in chapter 7, in my opinion, extend to some specific things beyond 70 AD. But they are a striking exception. And most of the prophecy of Daniel 7 happened before 70 AD, but there are a few things related to the fall of the Roman Empire and its aftermath that are there too. So I wouldn't, I can't be absolute, and I wouldn't have any interest in being, because I'm not a full preterist. If I was a full preterist, I'd have to find some way to include even those things before 70 AD, even the fall of Rome and the burning of the city of Rome. Maybe they would see that in Nero burning Rome in 64 AD. I don't know, but I personally see the burning of Rome in Daniel 7 as fulfilled later than 70 AD, and one of the extremely few things referred to in the Old Testament that would speak of it. And it's in a prophecy that spans many centuries long, most of which happened before the time of Christ. And, just a few of the details extend beyond the life of Christ. So it's not an absolute statement. It shouldn't be. I'm talking about the idea that many people think that a lot of events happening in modern times, or that will happen in the end times, have some kind of prophecy in the Old Testament that speak of them. And then they're going to try to find them in Zechariah or Joel or Isaiah or Ezekiel and Jeremiah. And I don't believe that those books have anything to say specific about events that can be anticipated in our time or in the future. Though I do believe that all those books mention the formation of the church, of course, at Pentecost, and the continuing career of the church, which, of course, goes beyond 70 AD up to our time until the end of the world. So I would say that the Old Testament does speak of certain processes that began before 70 AD and continue beyond it. But when we're talking about specific events, like if you're going to read in the newspaper, oh, this thing happened, whatever it may be, and we've got this prophecy in the Old Testament, I think you'll never have occasion to do that. All right, let's talk to Roger from San Luis Obispo, California. Hi, Roger. Welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thanks. This is my first time calling. I'm a new listener to the radio show.
Well, thanks for calling. Good to have you.
Thank you. I had two hopefully quick questions. My first question was, have you ever heard of Witness Lee and Watchman Nee?
Absolutely.
And if so, do you know any information about them? Are they good or whatnot?
Well, I have more reservations about Witness Lee than I have about Watchman Nee. And Watchman Nee was not perfect, but he was a great Christian and a martyr. Watchman Nee, of course, was the leader of a small movement that called the Little Flock in China before the Communist Revolution, before Mao Zedong came to power. And this, he was a leader of quite a few churches, and he spent a lot of time in prison. Like the last 20 years of his life, he spent in prison being tortured and dismembered by the communists. He went through hideous things in his years in prison before he died. He died in the 70s. He was a native Chinese man, who was beloved in the Chinese church and happened to be there at a time in China, which may resemble times that we will see in our lifetime in America. Who knows? Where, evil takes over the government and hunts down Christians and does these kinds of things. And it's happened throughout history. I'm surprised how many Americans seem to just live with the assumption it can't happen here. Certainly it's a gratuitous assumption. But in any case, when evil took over China, he suffered very much. Now, from prison and even before prison, he gave lots of talks. He didn't write much, as far as we know. Most of his books, and there are many books of Watchman Nee's, were not written by him. At least what I've understood is he gave talks to gathered church leaders of his movement. And the notes were written down, the people wrote down what he said, and then they got published as books. These books are mostly very edifying and greatly appreciated in the Western church as well as in the Chinese church. And I know in the 70s, a lot of us teenager Christians were reading Watchman Nee, and he was one of the guiding lights of the Jesus movement revival. He was influenced by a number of theological streams, some of which I don't agree with. He was influenced, for example, partly by the Plymouth Brethren in his eschatology, that is his end times teaching, which was dispensationalism. I don't agree with him in that. Though he was also influenced by the Plymouth Brethren in terms of his ideas about church order and church government, and I do agree with him in those things. His book, The Normal Christian Church Life, is one of the finest treatments, in my opinion, of what a normal church is supposed to be like. He was excellent on that. He wrote lots and lots of books. His theology is generally considered to be very orthodox, although he had influences besides the Plymouth Brethren. I think there's some Presbyterian influence. There was some Roman Catholic influence, even. Roman Catholic, he believed, for example, in purgatory. So he was kind of a theological patchwork quilt, and yet he's not so much admired for his theological expertise as for his godly and faithful life following Jesus, living like Jesus, and suffering and dying faithfully for Jesus. I mean, this is it's awfully hard to find things to say against a man, even if you disagree with some of his theology, when he's tortured and faithfully confesses Christ till the day he dies in prison after 20 years of torture and imprisonment. So this is Witness Lee, and his books, are most of them available and good reading. Some of them are really hard reading, and some of them I haven't read. I've read some of them and not others. He wrote a three-volume set called The Spiritual Man, which I've never fully read, but I have friends who have, and they say they're very difficult books because of the high standard of spirituality that he places on it, on the normal Christian life. And his books had names like this: The Normal Christian Life, The Normal Christian Church Life, The Normal Christian Ministry, and things like that. He basically taught about what the norms were, biblical norms were, in these areas. And while, again, I don't agree with everything he said, he did say some things that are extremely valuable. And I do think his book, The Normal Christian Church Life, as I said earlier, is definitely something everybody should read. Now, Witness Lee was a younger protege of Watchman Nee. I believe there were like two or three young Chinese men who were very close to Watchman Nee, and when he was imprisoned, or maybe after he died, they kind of took leadership of the movement. And Witness Lee came over to America and kind of headquartered in Anaheim, California, and started what was called the local church movement.
Right.
And he led that until the time of his death. He has been somewhat exonerated posthumously, but he was viewed as a cult leader by many when he came over here because his teachings, it sounded like he was not Trinitarian. He seemed to be oneness. That would be modalist, actually, and didn't believe in the Trinity. But his writings have been re-examined by people like Institute for Creation Research Institute, And they have come out and exonerated him. They, you know, 40 years ago, they called him a cult leader, but they came out 10 years ago or so and said they were wrong and that they've looked at his writings more carefully and they don't believe he was a cult leader. That is to say, based on his Trinitarianism. But there were other things about him that were rather strange. And many people say these were not due to him being a heretic so much as just the cultural difference between a Chinese Christian and in the Western world. But I don't know that all of it had to do with being Chinese. I mean, it had a lot to do with being kind of, off the rails, it seems to me. Now, we no doubt have a lot of Witness Lee's followers listening in, and they may not like what I have to say. But back in the 70s, when he had first come to America, I had occasion to hear him speak in Anaheim, and I also had dealings with a church in Santa Cruz that was answering to Watchman Nee. Answering to him, but they were part of the movement. And the people in that church were wonderful people, and I have no doubt that they were true Christians. But the movement itself did have certain cultural peculiarities. For example, Witness Lee taught that if you can get somebody to say, "O Lord Jesus," three times, they'll be saved. That calling on Jesus, calling on the name of the Lord three times like that would get a person saved. That's a strange doctrine, it seems to me. He believed that their movement was the recovery of true Christianity in the end times, and that he himself was either number one or number two in the recovery. That is, one of the first people recovered by God in the end times of the restored church, and that all the other churches were Babylon. And sometimes the local church people would go and they'd stand in front of churches and protest them and call them Babylon. Whereas they just called themselves the church. Wherever they were, they called themselves the church in that town, the church in this town, and the church in that town, as if they were the whole church, as if the other groups were not churches at all. And this is, regardless whatever theology they had apart from this, this is rather a cultic way to look at things. There was Witness Lee. If the reports I heard from his followers were correct in the 70s, was claiming to be the only living apostle at that time. Now, I never heard him say that myself, but I didn't listen to him that much, but I had lots of dealings with his followers, and that's how they understood his claims to be. And, you know, the earlier you got into his movement, the more prestige there was. I would meet people who say, you know, I'm number 437 in the recovery. The recovery meaning their movement. And, and you know, number 437 means in the whole restoration of the church in the end times, I was the 437th person to get in. And so, you know, if you had a small number, sort of like having a, you know, prestige of being, you know, it gave you some kind of something to talk about, you know, something maybe to boast about. In any case, the people in the movement were certainly Christians. At least the ones I knew were certainly Christian people. But they had cultural and other affectations that definitely made them different and were put offish. And in my opinion, Witness Lee had something of a cult leader type influence over people. Whether he was Trinitarian or not is not an issue to me. I'm not sure that any of his doctrines were a serious problem to be, although, you know, his eschatology would be different than mine and so forth. But I've never really worried so much about labeling people a cult because they have different theology than I have. It's more the sociological dynamics, the kind of control they have over their followers. When a group of people thinks that their leader is the only living apostle and that their group is the only church in the last days and that the other churches are all the harlot Babylon and so forth. These are just kind of cultic attitudes. Now, I don't know. I know the local church is still around. Even the radio station I'm on in Southern California plays. So, you know, the local church buys a half hour a day and plays Witness Lee talking, you know, on it. I haven't listened to it very much. But when I have, I haven't heard anything, you know, specifically heretical, nor for that matter, very specifically profound. Just a talk by a guy who seems to have an air of having insights that he thinks are better than insights other people have. And I frankly, I've never been impressed with him. I am impressed with Watchman Nee, his mentor, you know, who is a true, I believe Watchman Nee was a true saint and martyr. Witness Lee, I think in some ways he was a little off the rails. That's my opinion about him. But I'm not saying that people who, you know, are in his church aren't Christians or anything like that. But that it's the recovery movement. And usually when we think of recovery, we might be thinking of 12-step programs, but they have put out the Recovery Bible, which has nothing to do with 12 steps. It has to do with the teachings of Witness Lee being incorporated in the notes of the Bible. So anyway, those are a few thoughts about Witness Lee.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about the Recovery Bible. Is that a different translation, or?
I've not seen it. I don't know what translation they use. My guess is that they use some other, you know, some existing translation, but maybe they don't. Maybe they have their own translation. I think what makes it different would be the notes in it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is because I just recently came in contact with a local church home, I guess they call it local church home church or something.
Yeah, a lot of them meet in homes, yeah.
Yeah, like a denomination almost, or, I mean, like a specific group that kind of is scattered around that follows very closely these teachings of Witness Lee.
Yeah. I've always wondered why any group would particularly identify themselves with one leader like that. I mean, there's other dynamic leaders, certainly more dynamic than Witness Lee, in my opinion, who have similar groups. You know, they're guys who have now died, people like William Branham, for example, who worked apparently miracles of healing and prophecy and things like that, but who was also a little off the rails in his teachings and life in some ways. For example, William Branham said that he was the prophet Elijah and that he would never die before Jesus came back, but he did die in an accident. So, I mean, the guy obviously loses a fair bit of credibility when he makes false prophecies, but nonetheless, he did have or appear to have strong charismatic gifts that impressed a lot of people. And there, though he's been dead for years, because he was he died in the 50s, I suppose, or the 40s. He was big in the 40s. You know, there's still little home groups around that meet and read his writings, you know. So I think, okay, so these little groups, they think they're onto something that other Christians aren't onto, but they don't realize how many other groups under other teachers make similar claims about themselves.
Right.
And don't have any more credibility for those claims than their guy does. But, you know, it seems to me that it seems to me like anyone who's identifying himself with a given teacher rather than just Jesus is, you know, got some balance issues that need to be redressed.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much for that insight. It's helpful. And I had one Bible question. I don't know if I am monopolizing the time or if I have time to ask it.
Go ahead. We have a few minutes left.
Sure. It's Matthew chapter 5, verse 22. It's one I'll read it real fast. It says, but I say unto you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. So my question is just kind of a curiosity, I guess. Why is God kind of, I guess, very
hard on people who say fool and not so hard on Raca?
Certain levels of judgment.
Right. This is a verse, I think, that follows a very Hebraic structure where the same idea is repeated and intensified. Can you hear me? Am I not connected to you? Hello? Can you hear me, Roger? Okay, Roger can't hear me anymore. I hope it's only him. I don't know if anyone on the air can hear me. Studio, would you, kind of message me there on the screen and let me know if I'm still coming across? Because if I've become disconnected, I better do something about it. In Hebrew poetry, and Jesus often uses Hebrew poetry too. Thank you. The main characteristic of Hebrew poetry is repetition of the same or similar thoughts twice or more. And each time the idea is repeated, it is stated a little differently. Perhaps in the course of repeating it twice or three times, the idea is intensified. But it's not like it's three different ideas. It's more like saying the same thing three times, three different ways. And I think that's what we should see this as. Otherwise, it's very strange, because Jesus said, you know, if you say to your brother, Raca, you'll be in danger of the council, which apparently means the Sanhedrin. That is, you'll be in danger of, you know, the courts. But if you say to your brother, you fool, you'll be in danger of the fire of Gehenna. Now, I know our translations say hellfire, and this is a little misleading. If you have marginal notes in your Bible, it should point out that the word hell is actually Gehenna. And I myself am not persuaded that the word Gehenna should be translated as hell. I don't think it's talking about hell. In my book, All You Want to Know About Hell, I have half of a chapter talking about the word Gehenna and what scholars say about it and what the other parts of the Bible say about it. I don't think Gehenna is a reference to hell necessarily, but it is a reference to ultimate judgment of the Jewish nation. And speaking to them, he says, you guys think that you're just in trouble with God if you commit murder. But you know, murder is just acting out a certain defect in your heart of hatred toward your brother, or anger toward your brother when you shouldn't, when you should love your brother instead. We're supposed to love your neighbors, you love yourself. So if you have unwarranted anger toward your brother, if you call him, if you speak abusively to him, saying, you fool, or Raca. Now, of course, Jesus says these three things in a certain order, but I'm not really sure that they're that different from each other. To be angry at your brother, to call him fool, or to call him Raca, which is an Aramaic word that just means you empty-headed, you know, worthless fellow, which has a very similar, you know, spirit behind it as calling him fool. The idea is, if this is the way your heart is toward your brother, if this is the way you treat your brother, you're in danger. You might think that as long as you don't murder your brother, you're free from judgment. But that's not true. Because, of course, God is always watching the heart. It's like what Jesus said about adultery. You may think that if you don't sleep with your neighbor's wife, then you're cool with God. But if you look at her to lust after her, you've committed adultery in your heart. And it's a similar thing here. He's saying, murder, of course, will get you the death penalty in Israel. But even if you don't get the death penalty for and don't commit murder, you may be in similar trouble with God under his judgment, especially the judgment of Gehenna, which I take to refer to the judgment that was coming on the nation. I don't think that's a reference to hell, but I do believe in hell, but I don't believe that that's referring to hell, although the translators follow a traditional custom of translating Gehenna as hell. Gehenna means the Valley of Hinnom. Everybody knows that, but they still translate it as hell anyway. In any case, the point I think he's making is, I think he's making the same point three times. If we see him making three different points, it is indeed difficult to explain. Why would it be that you'd be in danger of judgment for hating your brother, for being angry at your brother, and you'd be in danger of the Sanhedrin for saying, you know, empty-headed, worthless person to him, but you'd be in danger of hellfire or even Gehenna fire if you say fool? Why is fool so much worse than Raca? I don't think it is. I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. I think to the Hebrew listener, they recognize the repetition of the same idea for intensification of the idea. And that's something a little foreign to our way of talking. But, of course, much that we read in the New Testament is a little foreign to our way of talking, because we're not Jews. And especially in Matthew, Matthew retains a lot of the things Jesus said in a Hebraic idiom. And that, I think, is one of them. Confusing, I know, but that's only because we're culturally removed from the hearers. But that doesn't mean we can't get behind what they would understand. We're out of time for today, though. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.